This is the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Justin Kaufman is sitting in today because we're, again, flying without our fearless pilot, Rokan, off for a couple of days, back on Friday.
Back on Friday, I'm excited to be here. 2 days in a row. It's consistency.
And something about you, Justin. When you sit in that chair, it's like all heck breaks loose. So
a lot to talk about today.
Definitely is.
And you know when, and I think this is probably an indication of where we are in our society, but when a high school shooting is fourth or fifth on the list of things to talk about on a busy news day,
I don't know what that says, right? I don't either. You know, it's right. There's so much going on in the political world. There's so much going on locally that you're right.
It was two kids killed, 17 more injured in a Kentucky high school.
Yeah, you think
terrible. You would think about that. A story like that where 17 people would be injured would be breaking news and scrolls and 24-hour coverage just 5-10 years ago. And just where we're at in our society right now, it is a secondary story.
It's true.
It's terrible.
Sadly, we've seen far too many of them. We will talk about that today, and Judy, of course, will have that in her news throughout the day, but we're going to be following the events in Washington. We're going to be talking to A.B. Stoddard. I don't know if you saw this today, but did you see Senator Schumer say, I'm taking back the wall funding? It's off the table. Talked about that last week. That was part of the deal I discussed with the president. It's off the table. Obviously feeling a lot of pressure from the more progressive wing of his party. Obviously that's contributing. And then conservatives now lobbying Paul Ryan to say, hey, we believe we won this first round. Now let's go even more hardline on immigration, more hardline on DACA, and discuss the visa lottery and all these other issues that there really is no center point of agreement. So it couldn't seem to be farther apart, but we'll get the latest on that.
I mean, that's something. I mean, we'll talk about it. We got a lot of people to talk about it this week, but it's amazing to think that what happened in the showdown that happened just to end last week is going to happen again. Set your watches for February 8th. So they're going to try to do
16 more days.
In 16 days, what they haven't been able to accomplish in, what, 30 years?
Yeah.
And there's something to be said about the mounting obstructionism that's already happening, whether it be from political factions on the liberal side or the conservative side, that say everyone's gonna ask for more and try to even make this more difficult for Congress to act and have a deal on immigration and get a spending plan.
And how do you do that in 16 days?
I don't know.
Well, we're gonna ask those questions because Aaron Katursky is here from ABC News. He has his finger on the pulse of such issues and matters, and so does A.B. Stoddard. She'll be coming up later in the 5 o'clock hour of our show. We also have Skilling back, as we mentioned. We're happy to talk to him. I've missed Skilling.
We talked about all the hail last night.
Yes, that was a problem.
It's a lot of hail.
Yes.
I did not see that coming.
I must have missed it.
You didn't see it by you, Violetta?
What time was it?
It wasn't that late. It snuck up on me, too. I was panicking. I'm like, what is that noise?
Yeah. I was just watching the 10 o'clock news last night.
Uh-huh.
I heard it for about 60 seconds.
Yeah,
the pictures were crazy.
Of you know, huge size hail. But I always have a problem. I want to talk to Tom about this. There is nothing that scares me more than 50-plus degree January days. Because usually... You know that when the real winter comes in, there's going to be some chaos that happens when those two fronts meet.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people are like, it's so warm.
No,
it's
you
so
know.
Nice. I'm like, no.
It's okay in the spring when the weather's truly breaking. There's a very different feel.
It's supposed to be.
Or when there's thunder and lightning in the middle of January.
Not good.
A couple nights ago. It's like, whoa.
It's like a horror movie.
It doesn't feel right.
Right.
And Kevin's back. We have to say that. He was gone a couple of days. We missed you too,
guys.
Missed you, man. Missed you.
Good to be back.
And there wasn't the appropriate amount of Brady back bashing on the show with you and Rogan yesterday. People were in agreement with me that he's the greatest of all time.
I heard you guys dabble into that. It is tough to hate on him right now. It really is. It's pretty incredible what he's doing.
I tried with Luke and Ellis and he got mad at me.
He did.
And because I was like, well, he got a little help from the refs, didn't he? He's like, wait a second. Like,
I think we can all finally agree that avocado ice cream and $150 ripoff pajamas actually do work when you cut your hand open. I think, you know, like people say, yeah, just rub some dirt on it. That's the new Brady analogy. Rub some avocado ice cream on it.
Avocado ice cream.
And the sleep pajamas, they do work. Yeah. We mock them on the show regularly. Those special, what were they, $200?
$150.
$150.
Yeah, low price.
Low price for the special sleep. We got to get some of those, Kevin. You got to try those out. Imagine you do such a good job now. Imagine if you were sleeping in those pajamas, how you could deliver for us.
Be a better broadcaster with those pajamas?
Wow. I can't.
I think you wear them to work. I think you don't just sleep in them. I think you wear them.
I like that.
You go full on.
Keep me loose. Feel the energy in the sports.
You bring
booth.
A little style to this show. This show needs some style. Everybody's all dressed up.
Yeah. Did you see the story about his jersey being protected this year? Because I had totally forgotten about that. Last year, someone swiped his jersey. That guy's banned from ever going to a Super Bowl, but they're really protecting it.
Yeah, they got found in Mexico, right? Didn't it make its way all the way back to Mexico?
Yeah.
And we were in Mexico that week or something.
Oh, that's right.
They were looking. They were investigating.
We were
you.
On the suspect list.
Yeah, they were going to get Robert Mueller to investigate the Rokon show.
Particularly Anna, who probably
was high on the suspect list, I'm sure.
You were suspect number one. You
but I wouldn't want to do anything to harm Tom Brady. That's different because you know, it's his jersey. I'd want him to have it or his mom to have it or something
Who pays for the extra security to watch his jersey this Super Bowl? That's the only question I have. What are the economics of it? Who has to pay? Is it more security for the stadium? Do the Vikings have to take it? Does the NFL have to take it on? The Patriots have to take it on?
Taxpayer dollars,
who knows? If there are taxpayer dollars involved,
Minnesotans should be furious.
Furious.
That sounds like, a protest could erupt on that one.
Security gate.
Security jersey
gate. Does the Philadelphia Eagles have to pay to help protect his jersey?
They should pay. They should, if they want to raise the money, they should charge a tax for every swear word that a Philadelphia Eagles fan throws out after the game. I don't know if you saw the videos this week.
Oh, yeah.
There were after the game, the Vikings fans were leaving. It was a blowout. The game's over. And Philadelphia Eagles fans were just in.
Did you expect anything less from them?
It was a 38-7 win. You could pretty much just laugh at the fans, but they were like swearing. They were on them. It was just like, I'm not sure what you're trying to get at.
This is a fan base that booed Santa Claus. They normally heckle teams' buses as they leave the stadium. They throw eggs at it. They throw beer cans at it.
But what I thought was interesting, I thought it was very interesting, the age bracket, because that was a young crowd.
I was thinking
crowd.
The same thing. It
so
was like
learning
a total millennial crowd.
Yeah.
Right. They start them young in Philly.
They're all proud. The parents are sitting at home going, I'm so proud of my son. Yeah. They're swearing at those Vikings fans when they left the stadium.
Well, the one Eagles fan I'm sure everyone has seen by now, running in the subway.
We
can't update everyone that he is okay. He talked to a local news group.
How are you okay after getting hit like a major concrete pillar? Isn't that what happened? He walked right into it?
He's a big boy.
Trying to get the train?
it was the biggest hit of the night for sure.
Might have been some alcohol involved in that scenario. I'm guessing that probably happened. Well, we will have some Tom Brady somehow in the show. I mean, I don't know how we're going to work it in later, but we will.
We'll figure that out.
We'll revisit it.
Anna has a 2 Tom Brady reference quota for every hour.
Should we all
of the
cut
Rokon
our thumbs
show?
Open and do the show with cut thumbs to maybe like perform better? Because, I mean, TB12 came up huge with a massive slice on his thumb.
Can you believe it? I remember everyone was doubting that even was real, and then they showed the close-ups right in the pregame. You're like, wait a minute, this is real. How is he going to play?
I thought it had gone the line a little bit when Tom Brady or Jim Nantz started the broadcast saying that Brady wore 2 gloves to their CBS production meeting. Because normally, like, you know, the high-profile player will meet with the play-by-play guy, they'll talk for a few minutes, and even then, in that moment, I mean, it was probably a little bit overboard with the gloves for TB12.
Yeah, there's a lot of enthusiasm about the game, though. You saw the prices of the Super Bowl tickets are astronomical, a little crazy, but you know,
somebody already bought 4 tickets for $80,000, 6 rows up from about the 50-yard line from behind the Patriots sidelines.
Wow.
$80,000.
Four
tickets.
To hang out in downtown Minneapolis.
It'll be
a Super Bowl.
Single digits.
Super Bowl. Are you going this year, Kev?
No, but we will have a full contingent up there. We've got Adam Hogue, Jared Payton will be up there, Ryan Burrow is going to be up there. So,
all right.
We've got a few, we got a crew up there.
Good. This is the Rokon Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Justin Kaufman here today as Ro has taken a couple of days off. And we want to head right over to Bradley Place, check in with Ben Bradley.
That's what they're calling it these days?
We call it that. Ben calls it that. So he tells us to call it that.
Yeah, and that's not even an honorary street name. That's the actual city of Chicago designation.
You should put a Ben Bradley honorary street thing right in front of WG. Just let them know you're there.
Yeah, just put Ben right up on the street sign ahead of Bradley Place.
That was part of the negotiation to get you over to 9?
Yep.
Bradley Place?
In lieu of compensation.
Yeah.
They like those offers, right? Hey, in lieu of compensation, I've got a couple ideas. Great. How much can we knock off the deal?
Offer. Yes.
So we want to get to the Skyway situation. Mm-hmm. That's, that turned into be more than we thought yesterday afternoon. I know you have a friend who has a personal connection to this. But first, did you guys see this? It sort of broke this afternoon. The Illinois Capitol, people are being told to use pencil-sized stream of water when they wash their hands because of Legionnaire's disease, the possible presence of the bacteria behind
Legionella.
It.
Right,
that's right, the Legionella.
That's the bacteria that can lead to Legionnaires.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And you know, we reported a little bit on this at 9 o'clock last night after the Secretary of State's office, which operates the Capitol complex down in Springfield, sent out a memo to all state employees who work there saying a preliminary test indicated the possible presence of the Legionella bacteria as a precaution. They were telling people to... not use any showers. Apparently, there's a couple showers there in the Capitol building.
Who knew
building.
That? Have you seen those?
No,
I've been down there. That sounds creepy, but
yeah,
maybe
I think they're
not.
In leadership offices.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think there's one in the governor's office they mentioned in the article.
Yeah, they indicated, though, that nobody had come down with Legionnaire's disease. This is in the hot water supply, and that this is a preliminary test result. The other thing the memo said is, don't worry, you can't get it by drinking the water. It comes from... inhaling the mist of the water. Not sure that would make me feel a lot better if I was down there, but nonetheless, they've already commissioned another round of tests to try to confirm what exactly is in the water there. They're going to have those results in the next 2 weeks or so. But boy, isn't that timing interesting, right after Governor Rauner moved into the Veterans Home in Quincy for 6 days to try to put an end to that Legionnaire's disease story.
Sure.
He's got that problem now at the state capitol.
I think that what you do is you put Legionella removement, a line item in the budget. Right. And then they'll, because they're interested in their own health, they'll pass the budget. Right.
That's interesting.
I'm political at heart. See,
I like that
see how
plan,
that would work.
Justin.
Right. So that's
something
the problems
mandatory
of the
work.
State are all, you know, they're all abstract until it impacts a lawmaker.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Make
that's
it
right.
attach to their salaries. I
yep.
would propose.
But
exactly. Here we go. Let's talk about the Skyway, because yesterday that seemed to be a traffic scenario and it seemed like a tragic accident. And then we realized someone had jumped from the Skyway bridge right around 95th Street. And then divers recovered the body. But now we're learning more about it. Right, Ben?
Yeah. Fascinating. So what seemed like it could have been, you know, just a traffic crash that for some reason led to a guy jumping off the Skyway. It now turns out that police traced the car back. It was registered to an area in the East Chatham neighborhood in a home where they found a young woman's body. She apparently had been stabbed multiple times. So now they're looking at the possibility that the guy who got into the crash on the Skyway and jumped to his death may have been involved in this woman's death. I had a friend of mine who happened to be driving on the Skyway, and he said this crash happened just a couple of cars in front of him yesterday.
Gosh.
He said, you know, the car spun out, all of the airbags deployed, and so from his perspective, he couldn't see inside that car. And then suddenly, from the back seat, the only occupant of the vehicle got out, appeared to be bloody, and was holding his head, appeared a little dazed, as I think, you know, anyone who had just been in a traffic accident like that would have. But then he, according to my friend who saw it, walked over to the edge of the Skyway, looked down, and this was a portion of the Skyway that was over land, and my friend who witnessed it said he actually then went to a different section of the Skyway that was specifically over water.
It's a long way down.
Got up, jumped. It's about 125 feet.
What?
Jumped, and then the Marine unit came, and they found his body a short time later. But, you know, I asked my friend, I said, well was there indication of a pursuit? Did it, you know, did this guy
feel like
he had crashed and had been boxed in? He said, no. In fact, my friend was one of the people who called police to say, hey, we just saw this crash. And he jumped before police arrived at the scene.
Oh, well. Anybody in the other, any other cars injured in as a result of this whole thing?
Or? You know, the picture I saw from the scene did not indicate there was. And like I said, my friend was about three cars back. So, you know, I know he
Lucky
was able to stop in time. But yeah, I mean, he was quite shaken just by seeing that, because your first instinct after seeing a crash is, you know, let me get out to help. And just kind of as the whole thing, you know, unfolds in a matter of seconds before your eyes to see that was, you know, quite shocking. And then to find out the backstory.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. Her death has been ruled a homicide, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. And so, and she was in his house. Do we know any more
about... Well, she was in the house where the car was registered
to. Where the car was registered.
You know, if he was in her car or something like that. But they're roughly the same age. I believe they're both in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know the relationship between the two, but that's something that detectives are looking at right now.
What a story.
It really is.
Yeah.
And then the fact that your friend witnessed it but is okay, that's... Certainly good to hear. What else you got coming up, Ben Bradley, on the WGN TV News?
Well, today we're keeping an eye on the latest developments, of course, out of Washington. They continue to come fast and furious. We're also going to go back out to that school in Aurora that had to shut down, not just for a day or two because of the flu virus, but an entire week. Students, I think, were getting put on buses because it's a residential school and being told to head home. So we've got that story for you. Also, Julian Cruz is working on a story. I just pulled a blank on that one.
Well, let me check his Twitter feed and see what he's talking about. Yeah.
He's a great reporter, so I'm sure it'll be good.
Well, the truly embarrassing part was in our editorial meeting. I said, boy, that's a really interesting story. Should we
I'll
play
be sure
that
to promote it on radio
the,
for you.
In the newscast. That was great.
I can't save you here. I don't see it.
You know what it is? It's Julian is covering the story of a couple that was in the Philippines doing volunteer work and had crashed. Had been involved in a crash, possibly. The van driver that was helping them there do volunteer work may have fallen asleep at the wheel.
Ooh.
So he's talked with people who know those folks. Sounds like just a great group of people who went out there to give of themselves selflessly.
Yeah. All right, Ben Bradley, we'll be watching. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben. Try to remember what we're covering today when we're on TV.
Go back and
tell
apologize
I'm
to Julian.
A lot today?
You're busy. We get it.
Yeah.
Thanks,
big,
Ben.
It's a big Ben Bradley place.
Yeah, it is Bradley place. He's got to live up to that.
That's right.
All right, let's check in now. We've got 2 minutes away from Judy's News, and then we'll check in with ABC News' Aaron Katursky, find out what's going on in Washington. And the answer will be a lot, but we'll get more details coming up. This is the Ro Khan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Justin Kaufman is here today with us as Ro is taking a couple of days off. It was great to hear Judy's news there.
Tammy Duckworth, pregnant.
First, what'd you say again? First senator.
First senator in office to have. I actually should have said it
in
better.
Office,
I said the first senator to have a baby, which isn't true, but in office to have a baby.
Right. I guess it just sort of shows you the
inequities of
makeup
gender.
Of the Senate, right? Because you would think by now someone of childbearing,
right.
some
that's
female.
Why, that's
would
why have... I kind of said it incredulously.
I couldn't
first senator to have a baby?
You're absolutely right. That's ridiculous that this is the first senator to have a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And that says a lot about the Senate.
Yeah, I guess it does. And, there's also here the other sort of remarkable thing, and congratulations to Senator Duckworth, expecting her second child. She had a little girl back in 2014. This would be her second, and it would be due a few weeks after she turns 50.
Wow.
So good for her.
The U.S.
expanding her family.
The U.S. Senate, essentially 50 years behind everybody else.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, that's true.
Yeah, right. Continues to prove that notion.
Congrats to her. We want to get the latest out of Washington right now, and much is going on. For that, we're going to head out to Aaron Katursky, ABC News. And Aaron, it has been an eventful day so far. We've seen a lot of these days lately, haven't we? One of the things.
You remember there was a government shutdown because.
That was so 24 hours ago.
We saw the president for the first time today, first public appearance since the shutdown. How telling is it how fast things move when he wasn't even asked about the shutdown in his first appearance?
I noticed that because I saw the headlines that all said first appearance since the shutdown going into it. And then when you listen to it, not even an issue. What was an issue, though, is the story the New York Times broke today about how Attorney General Jeff Sessions has been interviewed by the special counsel's office, Bob Mueller, and that happened last week. And then they followed up with breaking the news that James Comey also interviewed by the special counsel, that happening last year, but we didn't know about it.
No, and look, none of that should come as any surprise. These are central figures in the ongoing investigation. And while we don't know what Jeff Sessions was asked about or told the special counsel, we can guess the script, can't we? We know that Jeff Sessions was intimately involved in the decision to fire James Comey, so that gets at potential obstruction of justice. And then we also know that he took two meetings with then-Russia Ambassador Sergei Kislyak during the campaign. And so those were undoubtedly fertile ground for the special counsel to probe. Whether it ultimately gets him anywhere, who knows? And President Trump said today that he was not worried about what Attorney General Sessions may or may not have said.
Not at all worried, he said. And, it's interesting because, this news breaks and you think, wow, there's just so much else going on. And the other question here was, is President Trump still negotiating a deal to either meet with the special counsel, or potentially it has been floated that he was trying to cut a deal, his lawyers were, to just answer like a Q&A kind of thing where it would be written correspondence with the special counsel's office?
And while there's no update on that, it's going to happen in some fashion. You know, you would be hard-pressed to imagine the special counsel concluding his investigation without in some way having President Trump answer questions. And that follows precedent. You know, Presidents, you know, Reagan and Bush and Clinton, certainly, even President Obama ended up before a special counsel. And I think that to have some format for the president to answer some questions is undoubtedly in the offing before this all gets wrapped up. Now, what form that takes is still up in the air.
Aaron, my question has to do with what might possibly being asked. I mean, obviously, Russia collusion is at the top, but is this as much about obstruction of justice when it comes to the firing of James Comey as finding out what happened with Russia?
I think so. At this point, it seems as if Comey is far more focused on questions of obstruction and even some other tangential things than he may be on the question of collusion. Collusion isn't a crime he can charge, but obstruction certainly is. And so it's whether the firing of Comey in and of itself was an attempt to obstruct justice, or whether the public statements that the White House made were truthful about why the firing occurred and whether that factors into it. So you can imagine Sessions being asked about the rationale, the letter that was written, who was involved in the decision, why was it made, and how Sessions answered. You know, again, can help inform how the special counsel moves forward.
Sure. The other thing, a tidbit that came out about Sessions today of significance, I should say, the FBI, there was reports out today, Aaron, the FBI Director Christopher Wray had threatened to resign over staffing changes, particularly at a senior level, that had been pressured or come from Sessions' office, that he was being felt pressured to make these types of staffing changes.
The pressure came from Attorney General Sessions on Christopher Wray. Sessions may have been channeling his boss when President Trump has tweeted about Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe being a Comey crony who should be fired. And so it seems Sessions took up that mantle and suggested it to Christopher Wray. Mm-hmm. And Wray, we're told, pushed back. Now, we here at ABC News, we haven't been told that he threatened to quit. Axios first reported that, but we were told that the message from Wray was, thank you, I'll install my own leadership team when I'm good and ready. That may be a distinction without a difference, quite frankly. I think the administration is keen to avoid another spectacle involving the FBI, so any pressure, you know, would be untoward at this point. But the message was quite clear. And today we saw Christopher Wray appoint a new chief of staff, removing, you know, the guy who had done it under Comey. But Sessions has been undoubtedly channeling his boss in trying to get the FBI leadership team in place without the taint that President Trump seems to think. The White House said today in a statement, without denying that you know, there'd been pressure on Wray, that certain senior figures at the FBI under the Comey regime had tainted the reputation of the Bureau.
Yeah. And you saw the president tweeting about that, the text recently about the 5 months of missing text messages between those two agents. You know, that been involved with the investigation of the Clinton emails and briefly the Russia probe.
Aaron, where are we on that? Where are we on the fact that those missing texts are still at large?
Well, two things. One, we heard from Senator Burr of North Carolina that he believes there was just an honest mistake or error or technical malfunction. He didn't think there was anything nefarious in the FBI not being able to turn those over. So, certainly. President Trump and his allies may disagree with that, but beyond the machinations there's always been a healthy skepticism in this country about the politics of the FBI, and that goes back to J. Edgar Hoover. Mm-hmm. So there is a committee that's trying to get to the bottom of this and some of the political motivations, if there are any, and whether they made a demonstrable difference in certain decisions regarding the president or Hillary Clinton.
The other thing we want to make sure we get to, Aaron, because this is also important. It seemed as if at one point Senator Schumer had offered to get some funding for the wall and offered that to the president as part of a solution on DACA. And then today, very publicly, made it clear that that is off the table, no deal, we're not going to be funding any wall. You also saw conservatives digging in their heels and drawing a line in the sand, lobbying Paul Ryan, according to some of the reports, about making going a little more hardline than they even intended to on border enforcement and DACA and some of the issues that they're concerned with.
So apparently the taking the wall off the table happened on Sunday and not Monday, and that makes sense given his comments on the Senate floor when he said that the president walked away from a couple of different bipartisan deals and walked away from an agreement in principle on DACA with the wall funding made. Look, you know this is just going to be a bunch of finger-pointing, and mm-hmm. we may well be back here in 2.5 weeks discussing another government shutdown and no deal on DACA, although Senator McConnell said today he intends to keep his word to bring up a clean bill and how it ultimately looks. No one's saying just yet.
No, it just seems like the rhetoric has gotten even more, like it feels that they're farther apart now than they even were before. It seemed like there was some willingness to get to a compromise, and now both sides, if you're listening, the more progressive side of his party was so mad at Schumer yesterday,
yeah.
said he cut a bad deal. Why didn't you keep DACA in part of any kind of funding extension, even if it is only 17 days? And he certainly seems unwilling to go back to that stance he had before.
And I look, that can't be a surprise because there was always bipartisan agreement on DACA and the fate of Dreamers. It's popular with 74% of the country, according to the latest polls. And that's never been the issue. That what senators could agree to when it comes to DACA and Dreamers is not the issue here. It's whether the House will also honor Senator McConnell's pledge to bring it up,
right.
and whether the president would ultimately sign it. And all of a sudden, you heard the White House today kind of say, well, yeah, DACA and Dreamers, but also wall
right.
and chain migration and all that.
Tying it together.
And how this all is going to sort itself out. You know, if there was just an up or down vote on Dreamers in the Senate, I think it would pass overwhelmingly.
Mm-hmm. It seems that way. We did hear one Republican today say the idea of doing a DACA-only bill is pure fantasy. So we'll see if that happens as well. Aaron Kotursky, always good to hear from you. Thank you for weighing in with
us. Thank you.
Brokaw Show with Anna DeVlantis, Justin Kaufman in for Roe today. We were talking earlier about Tammy Duckworth, Senator Duckworth, being the first senator.
The first senator.
Be pregnant in the history of the United States Senate.
Which is a very long history.
Why do you? It's not like, well, since
1789. Total of 51 women in the United States.
I think I said this yesterday. Baby steps.
Baby steps, I guess. But and
I'm
a texter,
tired of saying that.
A texter pointed out.
Well, it was the purpose of the Women's March, one of the goals to shine a light on that and try to get more qualified female candidates out in the fray.
There was a texter text in who 6815 says there's a minimum age requirement in the U.S. Senate that will skew the data. But the minimum age requirement is what, 30?
30.
So that doesn't skew the data. I maybe at a different time, if you're talking about the 50s and the 60s, maybe women weren't having babies after 30, but I still find that hard to believe. I think it has much more to do with gender inequality.
Yeah, I had my first baby right at almost 30, 29, and I turned 30 a few days later.
Yeah, my wife was
34.
Wrong. So yeah, no.
And that was 20-something years ago. Yeah, it's just slow progress.
It really feels that way. First woman, did not know this, elected to the U.S. Senate in 1932.
Okay.
But that was after the death of her husband. She sort of took over and then became elected. Hattie Wyatt Caraway, but only 51 in the history of the Senate. So that's what skews the numbers.
And
you don't
have
a big pool to choose from.
What's the number now? I mean, how many female senators are there?
I think 20.
20 out of 100.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying. I mean, even today, which is arguably the most progressive time when it comes to gender equality in politics, 20.
20 total out of 100. So
that's ridiculous.
20%. But Tammy Duckworth making that announcement, very happy to be adding to her family.
Yes.
She has a little girl already who she had in 2014. And now she's going to have another little girl who she'll give birth to weeks after she turns 50. So there's another sign of progress, allowing women to give birth later in life as well. It's pretty remarkable.
I hope they figure out what's happening with healthcare.
Yeah. I think that, you know what's nice, the senators already have pretty nice health care.
But don't they?
So they don't have to worry.
I always
as
thought
much.
That they were on the Affordable Care Act, like they had to do the government health care.
No. I think they have sort of a gold plan.
They have the gold plan.
Provided.
Right.
If they did have to be on it, it would be so good. We'd all want to be on it.
It's so true, isn't it? It's like, I wonder what their plan is like. Wouldn't that be cool to be on that for a year and just not have to worry? But that's not the case. So we want to congratulate her for that. And let's talk a little bit about what's coming up here.
Yes, Tom Skilling.
He's back. I'm so excited he's back.
Yeah. We talk about his state away from his state, mm-hmm. Alaska, last night, earthquake in that area that almost a tsunami. Mm-hmm. Tsunami warnings. I woke up to them this morning. But obviously, if you're in Alaska, it's much more
so early in the morning,
traumatic
too,
than mine.
That would rattle you out of bed, literally. But he'll tell us about that. He'll tell us what to expect here after we had that hail yesterday.
I see in the short-term forecast, I see a couple more 50-degree days coming up. And like I said at the beginning, I don't like 50-degree days in January.
No, it's scary. Yeah, it is scary. I agree. We've got Judy's News coming up in 2 minutes. This is The Ro Khan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis, Justin Kaufman sitting in for Ro today, and Tom Skilling is back. We are so happy you're back, Tom.
It's good to be back, guys. I wanted to join you yesterday, but we had a computer issue here, so I was busy working with that. But it's good to hear your voices again. Justin, welcome.
Tom, I got to tell you about this conspiracy theory that some people here at WGN Radio have about you, and I just want to share with you. It's not me.
Okay.
Not Justin. They say it's a little suspicious that Tom Skilling goes on vacation and then there's always bad weather. It's this terrible inclement weather whenever you're gone.
Well, the cat is out of the bag. You know, it shows, Anna, the extent of my control over these things, you know. And if you believe that, I've got some cheap lamb for you somewhere that's, you know, for sale at a good price.
I don't. You deserve the break. You work so hard. You went to the Yucatan, right?
I did.
How was that?
It was interesting. I saw Chichen Itza, which is the big Mayan pyramid down there, and all the ruins. I found out that the whole Yucatan area is former Mayan country, and the people there are Mayan descendants, many of them. And then they have these limestone mines underneath, which are really cool. You actually... you get on a truck, they take you about 5 miles into the jungle, and then you descend, you put a wetsuit on and a helmet, because there are stalactites and, the stalagmites in there that you could bang
your
head on.
What's the difference again? Which one's the up one, which is the down?
The stalactites are the, the down one. I'm not a geologist.
Okay. All right. Putting you on the spot there. Sorry.
No, that's all right. I'm outside my area of expertise. Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. But I know is they could, it looked like they could do your head some serious harm.
Oh, yeah.
And besides that, they don't want you breaking them off because it takes, a long time for these things to form. Mm-hmm. The water percolates down through the soil, and it's really something. 20% of Mexico's fresh water resides in these limestone caves in the Yucatan, and I didn't realize that.
Oh.
So that was kind of cool. And then we went over to Cozumel and just for a day trip.
Because that's outside the Yucatan Peninsula, or is that considered part of it?
I think it's considered part of it.
Okay.
It's right off the coast southeast of Cancun there.
A lot of people go there. It's beautiful.
It is. It's lovely. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of cool. Everybody was remarking how chilly it's been, and they said recent winters have been cooler there, and that has to do with this wavy jet stream we get. It's interesting. Warming in the Arctic causes the jet to buckle, and then it comes down. The eastern U.S. Has these invasions of Arctic air, and it reaches right down into the Yucatan. And while the western U.S. stays unseasonably warm, and that includes the area all the way up to Alaska. So it's interesting. I bet if you went into western Mexico, they'd be telling you how unseasonably warm it is, just like in this country.
Well, one of your areas of expertise, Tom, is Alaska.
Yeah.
And yesterday, earthquake over 7 on the Richter scale. Tell us about, for you to have spent as much time as you have there and been a part of of trips to Alaska. What can you tell us about earthquake?
You know, Justin, I mean, that's very much on people's mind.
Yes.
Alaska is home to the biggest earthquake to occur in this hemisphere, a 9.2 Richter scale, and it occurred on Good Friday back in 1964, set off a whole swarm of tsunamis. And in fact, the majority of the people that died in that died of tsunamis in that area. But and we went up and did a program on the one-year anniversary of the Indian tsunami to talk to folks who had lived through that tsunami there. There were 100-foot waves that came into, like, Seward, Alaska, and Valdez, which is where the southern terminus of the pipeline is now, and hit Kodiak Island, which was an area really kind of unnerved by this big earthquake. But now, that was a 9.2, but when you put that in perspective, the San Francisco earthquake was around 7 on the Richter scale, and you know how historic that was in terms of the damage it did. But so it's been a while. Yeah, a lot of people, there's no real periodicity to these things, but people have been a little unnerved by the fact it's been so long since a big one's occurred. Yeah. And it's interesting, the epicenter of that Good Friday quake was, it's about 25 miles from where I go, which is about an hour south of Anchorage. And it's funny because different terrain there reacts differently. They had the collapse of a downtown area in Anchorage, whereas if you were on the rock, you didn't collapse. But we talked to a woman. They had just sat down. It was the day before her prom. And they had just sat down to dinner when that one hit at 5:34 in the evening. And her father said, let's go down into downtown Seward, the lower elevation area, and see how the family's doing. And she said they all got in a pickup truck, went down there, 7 of them. Right. And they got out, and everybody said, get up on the roof. And she didn't know why. She had never experienced a tsunami, but this black wall started coming in at them.
Oh, wow.
And I said, does it make a noise? Does it roar? Or what? No, she said, the only thing I remember is when it hit the buildings kind of blew up. And she said, we rode the roof of this building they had climbed up on for about a half an hour. And this was on a cold March day.
Oh, my gosh.
Spitting snow. And, of course, all the electricity goes out. The only illumination was they had upset these big fuel tanks, which burned. And every time successive tsunamis came in, there was another one around. The first one hit about 30 minutes after the earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
The next one hit about 11:30 at night. So, and then they kept coming because these things come in, you know, over and over again until it finally, the energy is dissipated.
Well, but luckily, this did not do
this
that.
This one didn't materialize in that way, but it seemed the watch stretched into California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia. They were all on alert for a potential tsunami. But
well, that one in 64 took out Crescent City, California, some distance away, did major damage. And, they found there were sea level shifts from that Indian tsunami that was so widely covered that were sensed all around the world. Tidal gauges showed that the oceans of the entire world oscillated some. If you got farther away, it was less of an impact. But
shows you how we're all connected, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. There are two centers that predict tsunamis. They're a branch of the Weather Service. One is up in Palmer, Alaska. We visited that and talked to the people there. And the other one's out in Hawaii. And together, they have jurisdiction over tsunami alerts for the whole United States.
Yeah. Well, the warning systems have improved over the years. I know certainly in Southeast Asia after that horrible one in 2004 that occurred the day after Christmas, I believe, when thousands of people were killed.
Oh,
they didn't have the warning system to let them know to be on alert and to take the kinds of precautions you just described. But now that has been changed. They have updated their systems there, and they have a good alert system in place. Has it improved even in the States in terms of the technology around it? Had you heard anything about that, Tom?
Oh, yes. All municipalities in these threatened areas do tsunami drills and everything else, just like they do hurricane drills in vulnerable areas and like we do tornado drills. Here in the Midwest. So it's taken very seriously, and you see these signs on the road saying this is a tsunami escape route so that you can get to higher ground. It was interesting. This woman said what they did was after the first one hit and it just decimated the town, somebody climbed up on a crane and watched the fires burning in these oil tanks. And when the next tsunami would come in, it would extinguish the fire, and that was a sign there was another one coming, so they all ran for higher ground at that point.
Wow.
So, pretty frightening stuff. Yeah.
Absolutely. Have you ever been in Alaska or anywhere during an earthquake or
yes.
a tsunami warning?
I have indeed, and it's quite interesting. They take it pretty seriously. The biggest earthquakes, I've had two 5.3s when I've been up there.
Jeez.
And it's pretty wild. One hit at 2:30 in the morning, and I thought a snowplow was going by. It kind of felt like that, and it lasted for about 30 seconds. But I visited the Weather Service office the next day, and they said had it gone on longer, the avalanches would have started at that point. So they have a lot of unique problems up there with those.
Well, it's just, you know, it's sort of like you think about in California, they'd just gone through the largest wildfires in California history. Then it burned that area, made it sort of put a sheen and cleared a lot of the debris. And then sure enough, as soon as they got the much-needed rain they had been praying for, even the couple months before, boom, you had those tragic mudslides that occurred right after.
And it seems to be that's the pattern we're going into now. We're going to see these extreme oscillations from periods of terrible drought to periods of too much rain. Mm. There's another huge storm going into the Pacific Northwest now, and it's going to drop a lot of rain out there, some mountain snows, and that's the one that's going to warm us up on Friday. Mm-hmm. We'll be on the front side of that just as we were on the front side of another storm. We're getting into a very active pattern the next 2 weeks. These storms are going to come along at regular intervals, and it will warm up for a couple of days ahead of the one thing, and then the cold air will come down the backside. But what's really interesting, February begins next week, and there are some signs that we've got a real Arctic outbreak getting set to come down in the early days of February, which would be later next week and into the following weekend. So winter is not over yet, even though we'll have a couple of warm spells before that occurs.
Tom, we were talking the danger, or at least we know when we have unseasonably warm winter days, 50s, and we just saw that, and what just came in the severe weather came through yesterday.
Yeah.
As we look towards do you kind of get stressed out? Do you get nervous when you see temperatures get up in the 50s or so in January,
February?
Yeah, you know, all weather on Earth is different. Is driven by differential heating, the fact that one area gets warmer than another, and the juxtapositioning of very cold air with very warm air is what sets up the jet streams that organize these big storm systems and tornadoes and so forth. So, you do worry. And La Nina winters are famous for their volatility and temperature. You know, you go into Arctic blasts that last a week and a half, and then you go into mild Pacific and Gulf air spells, and that's exactly what we've been doing. We've been bouncing back and forth between extreme cold and warm, although the extreme cold is not as cold as it once was. You know, like those ones we had back in the 70s.
Who can forget?
Climate change is having an impact even on the availability of cold air. It gets pretty miserable, but it's...
Yeah.
You know, we haven't had a 27 below zero or a 26 below like we did in 82 and 85 or any of those terrible winters in the 70s where you'd have a snowstorm and then you'd go down to 20 below zero, and we haven't had cold spells like that will last a week or more at a time.
Yeah, this just doesn't even feel like, as a human, it's hard to walk outside when it gets to be those types of weather. So thankfully, we're not in that kind of area. But where are we going next now, the next couple of days, Tom? Give us a
look. Well, it'll be chilly tomorrow. We'll keep a lot of clouds in here tonight and tomorrow. But this is really only seasonable. So as cold as it is compared to yesterday, this is really nothing by late January standards. We've been below zero, and we see nothing like that coming until perhaps this cold air hits later next week and the following weekend. But tomorrow, 30s, low 40s on Thursday and near 50 on Friday. And then we'll start in the mid-40s Saturday and cool off later in the day and turn cold again Sunday and Monday. And there might be some snow in there Sunday night, Monday. Not a huge storm, but might have a little lake moisture. And then by Wednesday next week, we'll go into another warm spell. Could get up near 50, and then the cold would hit after that. And that could be... there's some signs that might stick around for a while, as did that cold spell a couple weeks ago. So we'll see.
Keep an eye on that. Right. Thank you, Tom, and welcome back.
You bet, guys. Good to talk to you. Thanks, Anna. It's good to be back.
Very nice. The Rocon Show with Anna DeVlantis continues. We've got Justin Kaufman with us for the next couple of days as Ro's taking a few days off.
Enjoying it.
It's been fun. It's been action-packed, that's for sure. Tomorrow, we're going to have Lester Holt on. We should mention that. He was in North Korea.
He's in North Korea. I saw the stories today,
He's been filing some interesting reports. Just to have access to a place like North Korea
I think he
is
called
pretty rare.
The reporting, the journalism, calling the cotton candy candy journalism in North Korea.
What did he mean by that?
I think he was referring to the idea that, of how people are the state-run journalism.
Oh, I see. Well, he's interesting because he also mentioned in his reports, now I believe he's in South Korea or potentially on his way home, but he talked about how his itinerary was carefully controlled.
Yeah.
And you could kind of tell that by the places he visited, but it'd still be interesting to hear their views on Americans
absolutely.
And the access.
I say we send him back on our dime so he could do the phoner with Lester Holt tomorrow. He's got to be back in North Korea. So if we can get that done, Jeff, if there's a way that we can get him back on the red eye.
I think Nightly News needs him a little bit. We're very happy to get him
just
at
for the authenticism.
Yeah. Well, we love that he's going to be calling in on that. He was supposed to call in today, as I said, but tomorrow there's an issue for him over there. And so tomorrow he is going to check in with us. So we'll check in with him. Judy, very quickly, you've got the, you want to promote your appearance this weekend at the Goodwill store in Willowbrook.
Well, sure I do.
Never miss a chance to promote.
Right. Hello. I hope everyone comes out to the Willowbrook Goodwill, which is located at 6300 Kingery Drive, which is Route 83, and that is from 2 to 4. And I'll be displaying a big game day table of everything I bought at Goodwill, and then someone will walk away with that whole table.
Boom.
Your party, right?
So can you give away any of the, like, what you might have on that table?
Oh, gosh,
that might be
table? I've got beer mugs, beer glasses, a pitcher. I've got tons of trays. Oh. I have an awesome a cheese heater, I guess you could call it.
Like a fondue thing?
Yes, a fondue-ish
thing. But really
thing.
For queso, too, for this.
Oh, yes. I didn't want to mention the queso, but yes, if you know how to make good queso. And actually, speaking of that, I'll also have some recipes for the big game. And we're going to have a ton of other prizes, too. Tickets to the Hawks games. Northwestern, Bears. Also, I think Goodwill is going to be giving away $25 gift certificates. I mean, really, it's just all fun and games.
It sounds like it.
Place to be. Goodwill store in Willowbrook next Saturday.
See you there.
2 minutes away, Judy's News. This is the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Justin Kaufman is here.
I'm here.
Happy you're here, Justin.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be on the radio with you and the team here. The Rokan Show. Ro will be back on Friday. I'm just keeping the seat warm.
Mm-hmm.
Should I just play a random sound effect?
Sure. When he's away, we get to play with the soundboard.
Right. Let's see. Let's pick random. Nothing happened.
You have to, like, Lysol the seat after you leave because he's
If he finds, like, schmutz on the keyboard, that's bad news. It's going to be bad for you there, Justin. Is it not working?
Yeah, I got it.
His sound machine has, like, a fingerprint.
There we go.
I haven't heard that one from
haven't either.
You
where did you find that?
Lower left-hand corner.
Lower
that's
left-hand
where
corner.
The animals are.
That's a buzzer. Sorry.
They're over here.
Oh, that's okay. That one's used very often.
That one you want to keep handy because there are lots of reasons for that one.
That one works for a few different things.
I always think it sounds like a punch.
That one. That's different.
Ow, stop.
That one's different.
Yeah.
One differentiate those. But that's what we're looking for. It's all there for you, Justin.
One of these days, I will find command of the sound effects.
I honestly think it's stuck. The red light won't go off. Can you turn it down? We broke the soundboard. Don't tell Ro.
Ro's not going to be too happy.
It honestly won't go away, but that's okay. We'll figure it out.
I love it. He's going to come back. The minute he walks in the door, before he says hello and tells anyone about his vacation, he'll be like, what? I smell something. What's wrong with my sound effects machine?
My sound machine? And there's all these fingerprints everywhere, and he'll be unhappy.
Yeah. All right, we won't touch that for the rest of the show.
Let's leave it there.
When Dad's away, the kids will play. Well, speaking of playing, the Chicago White Sox and the Chicago Cubs, of course, only, 3 weeks, mid-February, right around Valentine's Day, they will have pitchers and catchers report for spring training. Surprisingly, Jake Arrieta, of all people, the free agent pitcher who, of course, Cubs fans around the world have come to love, is still unsigned.
How is
that
possible?
It's amazing to think about, and it's really all because of Yu Darvish, the Dodgers World Series pitcher, who a lot of Dodgers fans would like to forget, is actually the prized free agent, and he has not signed as well, and there seems to be a domino effect in place. Everybody waiting for Yu Darvish to sign and see how much he gets paid, and that sets the market. Am I right, Kevin? Is that how it's working?
Yeah, I would say that's accurate. I think owners are being a bit more stubborn, considering next year's free agent class is a little bit deeper. You know, basically it's Arrieta and Darvish, and then there's a little bit of a drop-off with guys like Alex Cobb and Lance Lynn. Cobb's a guy to keep an eye out for, because if the Cubs don't end up landing Darvish or bringing back Arrieta, Cobb's a guy who could be a target. He knows new pitching coach Jim Hickey. He pitched in Tampa Bay, and Hickey was his pitching coach. Madden knows him a little bit, so that could be a guy who probably won't be as expensive as Darvish and Arrieta, we think. I think Darvish and Arrieta are probably facing projected contracts much less than they had hoped for going into this year.
And you have to ask the question, Kev, and this is the question that I think a lot of people are scratching heads on. Is there collusion? I mean, does the Major League Baseball owners say, enough's enough, I'm not paying pitchers $200 million. Nobody signed these guys. Drive this price down.
Well, I think that's the thing. Owners have gotten smarter, and it's more of a general manager's game now than a manager's game. You know, I mean, think about the Cubs. As much as Joe Maddon, and as great of a manager as he is, probably one of the top three managers in all of baseball, think of how much more important Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer are to the Cubs than Joe Maddon. That's not a knock on Maddon. It's just the way baseball is going. Look at Rick Hahn of the White Sox. Rick Hahn has the biggest voice in that organization right now in terms of building that roster and going ahead with the rebuild and all those sorts of things. So I think front offices are smarter now. They look at advanced numbers, and you know, essentially the way free agency works, and Theo Epstein said this for a long time, when you have to dabble into free agency, really into any sport for the most part, but like football and baseball, you know, most of these guys, you have them for under control for 6 years. Those first couple of years you're paying them the league minimum, and then for 3 or 4 years you're going to arbitration, which means you come to an agreement on a reasonable number. You're not handing out $150 million contracts to a 25-year-old kid. So I think, you know, and then they enter free agency when they're 29, 30, 31. And if you look at numbers for any player, basically, the numbers are almost always going to decline. So these owners are like, wait a minute, we're supposed to pay you $150 million when we're almost positive you're going to decline for the next
5 years. I get it, but there's always one wackadoo general manager in Arizona or Minnesota or Seattle that's like, I'll pay this guy $300 million.
Well, I think that's...
So why is that not happening? Why is Yu Darvish not right now playing for, I don't know, the Oakland Athletics at $250 million?
Well, the A's don't have
whoever. I'm just random team.
Right. You know? I think it's a good question. I think there's a bit of a stubbornness between a lot of the owners and Scott Boras, who's the most high-profile agent in all of baseball.
Is that the agent here?
Jake Arrieta is one of his clients, and J.D. Martinez, the top positional free agent, and he's notorious for this. I mean, he's, you know, fans get a little bit annoyed with him because they're like, come on, we just want deals to happen. We want our team not to have to spend so much money. But Boras always will get the best deal for his players. That's why he has the most clients. So I think if you're going to talk collusion, Justin, I mean, I think there's probably, I don't know if I'd go as far with collusion.
Yeah, okay, maybe not.
With
but Scott, it's unprecedented, isn't it?
Yeah,
to have these top line free agents, Yu Darvish and Jake Arrieta, both World Series pitchers, on the sidelines because Major League Baseball doesn't want to pay that number.
I blame Russia.
Yes,
totally their fault.
I couldn't
and the
agree
other
more.
Question I would ask is that
and
you
Hillary.
Had that story in Hillary and thanks Obama.
Yes, thanks Obama.
The story about Darvish's one-time personal catcher being brought on board is maybe sort of then that just like fanned the flames of the rumors saying,
is there something we should look into
there? Is this
a
prelude?
Yeah, Chris Jimenez, they reportedly have come to agreement with him. He's pitched down in Tampa before, so he knows Maddon. He also, a few years ago, was essentially Darvish's personal catcher in Texas, but he also has experience with Alex Cobb, so I think it's a good signing for the Cubs. It doesn't,
that means Darvish is coming to Chicago?
I don't think for sure. I think it probably doesn't hurt, though, but, you know, according to Cubs Twitter last night, that was pretty much, everyone was like, oh my God, is Darvish going to be a Cub by the morning?
It is
very weird to see two free agents like Arrieta and Darvish. I think the big thing, guys, is it's not necessarily so much the amount of money, it's how long they're paying these guys. You know, I think the White Sox have long had a essentially an organizational rule in place, if you want to call it that, where they didn't want to ever give pitchers more than a four-year contract. And a lot of teams are dishing out 5 years. I mean, you look at Jeff Samardzija, got a 5-year, $90 million deal. Everyone's like, what?
Right.
He's going to eat up a lot of innings and all that stuff. But I think teams are probably willing to pay a little bit more per year than have to commit to 5, 6, 7-year deals.
Guess who's the most expensive, the highest paid player on the Chicago White Sox?
On the Chicago White James Shields?
You got it. It's a pitcher, James Shields. Because they absorbed his contract from San Diego, I think it was. And it's a 7-year deal, $140 million. It was crazy dumb money to pay a guy who was really at the end of his career. And the White Sox are on the hook. They got to eat it. That's why they can't trade him and they can't move him, and he's going to start this year.
Yeah. I mean, there's a potential. Like, I think they're what they're really dreaming of, which I don't know if would necessarily happen if Shields has a good first half and they move him just for something. But, you know, the thing that stings, and Justin, you and I before we're talking a little bit about Baseball America's top 100 prospects, and that comes out and it's great for the White Sox because right now they have five players on the top 100. But there's a player, Fernando Tatis Jr. You may remember Fernando Tatis, who played in Major League Baseball for a long time. He's now the, I think you want to say, ninth ranked prospect, and he was the guy that the White Sox traded to the Padres to get Shields. So now you're stuck with like this old pitcher who's no good. He's still got millions and millions, and then you're potential Tatis. But that's really the only sour note when you look at the White Sox prospects.
A question,
right now,
you know, because
it's a beautiful
thing. We saw that last year where the White Sox at the end, they had accumulated so many pieces. They had 10 or 12 guys that were on the top 100 list at the end of the year.
Yeah.
And some of those guys are going to be on the major league roster, so you can understand why there's five. But are we going to see these five? Are we going to see guys like that on the White Sox roster this season?
Robert's probably a stretch, considering he's, 20 years older, so you'll probably just see him work his way through the minors. They haven't made up their mind yet where they're going to start him, AA, single A, triple A. The guys you will see for sure are guys like Yoan Moncada, who came up last year, Reynaldo Lopez, and Lucas Giolito will be in the starting rotation to start. There's a good shot you're going to see Michael Kopech.
What about Jimenez, Eloy Jimenez, right?
Yeah, he's probably a guy you're going to see a little bit later in the year, I would guess, but Eloy Jimenez right now is the White Sox top prospect. He was part of that Cubs Jose Quintana trade that happened last summer. That was really the Cubs' last top prospect they had in their farm system.
Kev, I want to ask you about the Blackhawks, because I think front and center in a lot of Blackhawks fans' minds right now is Corey Crawford and his situation. I guess he was working out for the second day in a row, and I don't know how they're looking at it. Coach Q says things are getting closer, is what he said.
Yeah, I was actually surprised to hear that from Q, because he's like, I don't want to say he's... You rarely hear him be very open and optimistic, right?
His mustache is more expressive than the coach.
Normally, he just kind of growls at the reporters, like, I don't know. Yeah. But he was like, actually, he is. He's progressing. So it was like, whoa, okay, if Q's a little bit excited, they need him. They need him bad. I mean, this has been a weird year for the Blackhawks. I can never remember the Blackhawks being in last place in division this late in the year. I mean, at least for, the last decade, I want to say?
How about that? I would say it's a decade,
And they're 7 points out of the wild card. I think there's some definite concerns there, but... As we've talked about, they need to get Crawford back, and they need to score goals. They've been shut out twice in the past three games, and their power play is atrocious.
You know what this is? I mean, really, and not enough people are talking about it, but how much does the Blackhawks miss Marian Hossa? I mean, a guy who did not play this year because of the skin condition and probably maybe on his way to retirement, but wow. I mean, just not having that presence to gut out a goal when you need one. You're seeing, I mean, the power play alone. 0-for-6 last night. They seem to be broken on both sides here.
Yeah, it's very, very ugly. Q says he's been actually so far okay with the defense, which I know a lot of Blackhawks fans probably are rolling their eyes, considering sometimes you're seeing some of those guys get burned. But it's certainly frustrating to watch. You're just kind of waiting them to put a full, like, because we've seen it. It's been up and down. They win 4 or 5, and then they lose 3 or 4 straight. We want to see a full month of quality hockey. And we thought this was the month they were going to do it, considering 75% of the games were at home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a 6-game homestand, and they were 1-4 over their last 5. The homestand wraps up tomorrow night against the Maple Leafs, who are a pretty good team themselves. So 1-4 on this homestand? That's not what anybody was expecting.
I got to say, the hopeful news from Coach Q and just the fact that Corey Crawford is out there 2 days in a row, because there were so many headlines that were scary about, is he done for the season? What is the injury? And you, this team needs him, and we love seeing him. So that is very good news.
Well, you have Toronto tomorrow, then Detroit, and then the All-Star break. So that's 4 days. So maybe, who knows, maybe within the next couple of weeks. But
The Ro Khan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis, Justin Kaufman in for Ro. The next couple of days, Ro's back on Friday.
Such sweet music, Dan.
I know. That was very sweet. And speaking of sweet,
uplifting,
we've got some Tom Brady news. Still the GOAT, still the greatest of all time.
Is that the news?
But here's what I love. No, I just love this. I love this. Because it's on my Twitter, you know, timeline. Everything's hitting about Eagles fans are all saying, and if you go to like some of the Philadelphia newspapers, this is just fascinating to me. Super Bowl 2018, why Eagles shouldn't fear Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, and the New England Patriots. Telling yourself that. But it's funny how they're like, you know, trying to get in the heads and make sure no one's psyched out about this game.
I know.
I hope it's a real game. It really
does.
I
have all the respect in the world for Tom Brady, but you and I will differ in the fact that I'm ready to move on from the Brady show.
You want somebody else. Well, actually, that's funny. That's the other story that was trending today is his wife, Gisele Bündchen, had the news came out that she had been trying to persuade him to say, hey, you're 40. You, look what you've done.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and, you know, future Hall of Famer for sure, right? Obvious. Let's just hang it up.
Believe it or not, nobody's happier than the Patriots going to the Super Bowl than Commissioner Roger Goodell, because he was probably having an anxiety attack thinking of a Jacksonville Jaguars Philadelphia Eagles Super Bowl. Would have been a cherry on top of a season that seemed pretty low ratings.
Well, I have to say, I think part of the reason that the NFL ratings are down is because people are sick of the Brady and Belichick show.
Did you see the ratings from that game?
I'm sure it was a huge game.
Was the best ratings since the Super
Bowl. My point being that even Family Ties introduced a little baby at some point. You know what I mean? Like a new character. I'm just saying the Brady and Belichick sitcom continues to move on. It continues to move. At least bring in a new character.
Yeah, well, we hope the upcoming crop includes Mitch Trubisky, a guy named Mitch Trubisky.
See?
May not be next year, but let's hope it's very, very soon, right?
And if not a new player, maybe a new scandal.
Scandal? For
right,
whom?
Right. For any of these guys. A New England Patriots scandal. Yeah.
The storylines?
There'll be one. Give it a day.
Or some new $150 pajamas.
I think it's going to come down to the sleeveless sweatshirt that Belichick wore. I think they're going to find out that he was stealing that look from somebody, and it'll start a whole scandal.
Maybe someone stole his jersey, too, just like they stole Tom Brady's jersey last year at the Super Bowl, because that didn't seem to fit him. It was weird.
And it did look like he had some pythons under that sleeveless sweatshirt.
Some guns.
Belichick. So, I don't know. Maybe juicing? I'm just saying. Throwing things out. Maybe I'm just trying to find some scandals for
sticks.
Super Bowl media.
Not just Kevin into the muscle milk, you know?
Girls for the girls.
You never know. All right, we've got Judy's News coming up in 2 minutes, then a top 5 at 5 you won't believe. Once again, Lester Holt was scheduled to be with us today, but will be on with us tomorrow. He was in North Korea, now South Korea. Much to tell. We're excited to talk to him.
He just forgets his roots. You know, he forgets how much we gave him. The city gave him.
What an assignment. He loves Chicago. He tells us. And if you go do jury duty, you can still see him on the video there.
That's right.
The Daily Center. So you got that going for you. All right. Is that time of day when we do that special thing? You know, the thing?
It's the top 5 on the Rokan Show.
5.
Let's go.
4, 3, 2, 1.
Now, it's the top 5 at 5 on the Rokan Show with Anna Tavlantis. Sponsored by the Hip and Knee Center, where they help you feel new again.
Ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Get on with it.
Okay. Checking in at
number 5.
Big day in Hollywood. This year's Oscar nominations, they were announced this morning. But in addition to getting snubbed by the Academy, James Franco is dealing with negative press on top of it. One of Franco's alleged victims of sexual misconduct has opened up about her horrible experience. Sarah Tither Kaplan apparently didn't have the best time while taking one of the star's acting classes. And in an interview with Good Morning America, Sarah claimed that she felt exploited by Franco.
James is absolutely not a Harvey Weinstein. He is not an unfeeling monster who has no sense of reality. He created exploitative environments for non-celebrity women on his sets.
What do you want to say to James Franco?
A lot of things, but please just apologize.
So there you go. He was also, remember, he was wearing a Time's Up pin when he showed up at the past awards ceremony, and they said, well, that's hypocritical, and that maybe that's what's caused some women to come out to say that they're not sure he's really on board with the whole movement.
And he had what was it? Before the movement, there was the story about the 17-year-old girl on Instagram, and he had to come forward. And at that point, it was just more like, James Franco, he's just a bad guy, he's a bad boy.
Yeah.
And now this has changed. And frankly, there's a good question about whether or not should be nominated for an Oscar when in this controversy, of course, and whether or not that plays out when, you know, what you do off stage, how that affects your
art.
How
it affects the voting even, yeah. You know, because it certainly seems he was shut out of Oscar nominations. I'm not sure. We're going to talk to Richard Roper coming up in a little bit to kind of break down who was truly snubbed in the eyes of most of the people who do the voting. But you think that's got to play some kind of role, right?
And I don't think it's wrong. I think, you know, at a certain point, I mean, James Franco, you're voted on, you know, in that case, it's open voting, right? It's voted by your peers that, or people in that industry, in that community. And you know, a lot of people could make an argument, and I've seen it online, that it wasn't an Oscar-worthy performance in his movie. So, whatever. We'll talk with Richard about it.
We will see what Richard has to say about that. But that's right now, though. Checking in at...
Number four.
During a press spray in the Oval Office today, President Donald Trump said he's not the least bit worried. Not concerned at all, were his words, about the news that Attorney General Jeff Sessions spoke to Special Counsel Bob Mueller in the Russia probe.
Thank you.
Are you concerned about what the Attorney General told the Special Counsel?
No, I'm not at all concerned.
Did you talk to him about it?
No, I didn't, but I'm not at all concerned. Thank you all very much. No, he didn't at all. He did not. He did not even a little bit. Nope.
Yeah. Not at all. And shortly thereafter, it was announced that New York Times broke the news that James Comey also has already been interviewed by Special Counsel Bob Mueller. That happened last year. People didn't know about it. And now the news that most people are talking about.
I thought
about,
Comey was a leaker. How do we not know about this? He didn't tell his buddy at the professorship?
I'm sure he had an earful to tell them. And
let me tell you who I just talked to.
He certainly had those memos to go by, too. I'm sure they came up.
Meet me in the parking lot. I want to tell you about who I just talked to.
Now, the president could be sitting down with the special counsel as well. So that's something we'll be talking to A.B. Stoddard.
I hope that's pay-per-view.
With coming
I really
up.
Do.
Would you like to be a fly on the wall of that conversation? And then there's talk that it might not even be a conversation that his attorneys are trying to negotiate to make it more of a
I hope it's a
written
conversation.
Q&A
I hope that Donald Trump, the president, I hope that he takes in some of his past experiences as an entertainer and he recognizes that there is a money-making opportunity.
Oh,
it's $39.99 for the two-hour testimony, and we get to play bingo, collusion bingo. And every time it says there's no collusion, we drink. Like, there's a lot of things we could do with this story. And I would definitely...
Yeah, like certain buzzwords like Clinton and Comey would be an extra shot of something.
I would go in. If someone was buying that pay-per-view, I'd go in.
You would totally do it. Somehow I hope there's more dignity to the process than that. I feel there might be, even in these times.
You think?
Where
no.
We're not sure all the time
so.
If that exists, really. But that's what I hope for.
Right.
There's a bonus cut here. Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, we know her. She did outline one thing the president is concerned about. The Justice Department's report of missing text messages involving an FBI agent reassigned from the Mueller investigation.
I think he thinks that there's a great cause for concern that 5 months worth of text messages have gone missing, particularly given the individual part of that process has already been shown to be extremely biased against the president. You guys are absolutely obsessed with everything to do with collusion. If it has anything to do with the president, we hope that you'll take some of that same obsession, energy, and fervor and direct it to some of the places where it looks like there could have been some possibly illegal behavior.
I agree. I do not like the lecture tone from Sarah Huckabee Sanders, especially when she says the word obsessed. But I do agree that it's absolutely unacceptable that 5 months worth of text messages that people need to see, or that we're going back and forth with political bias, allegedly.
We've already seen some of the stuff they were talking about, so it leads you to believe there might be some other things there
absolutely.
That were worthy of public attention or certainly some kind of investigative attention.
I could not be in more support of the president and the White House to say that cannot happen.
Yeah.
And that goes across board. You can't at one point say, you know what, Hillary Clinton's emails, so what, she missed a couple emails. And then on the other end be like, well, you know, so what, a couple texts. No, if there is a transparency in the federal government, that stuff can't be misplaced. It just can't.
It doesn't feel right. And then you get to a point, though, where people do get worked up into a froth where you think maybe there's
It starts a conspiracy theory. It starts all of the 24/7 cable news talking about it. It's essentially you have to button up. You have to cross the T's, dot the I's when you're dealing with transparency when it comes to the federal government. That's unacceptable to have lost those many texts. Mm-hmm. Something tells me they're going to show up.
You think? they say they can get him potentially from the provider of the cell phone provider. As
I hope they call the provider store on the corner of Washington.
Go to Verizon. Walk over there and see if you can get the records.
Yeah, we need to get. We're looking for an FBI. Hold on. Let me put you on hold.
Yes, not always the best. You have to go know the ones to go to. I got a guy for you. I'll let you know. Okay?
Actually, we're taking a lunch real quick. So is there a way we can do this later?
My sister just had that experience at the store, one of those cell phone stores on
Sunday.
They
need to go to a cell phone store to get that information. Yeah. There's a sketch for you, SNL.
You think the wheels of justice are slow? The wheels of Verizon are certainly slow. Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis, Justin Kaufman in for Ro. He's taking a couple more days off. We're in the middle of the top five at five, and where are we? We're on
number three.
NBC's Megyn Kelly tore into Jane Fonda after Jane Fonda took some jabs at her over Kelly's plastic surgery question. Remember that? Back in September, made news, pretty big news. She asked her about her plastic surgery, wanted her to be candid about it. Jane did not like that interview some months ago.
I have no regrets about that question, nor am I in the market for a lesson from Jane Fonda on what is and is not appropriate. After all, this is a woman whose name is synonymous with outrage. Look at her treatment of our military during the Vietnam War.
Wow.
Many of our veterans still call her.
Wow. Going deep. That's a deep cut. That's a deep
really
cut to go
was.
Back. I don't know what I could make fun of Jane Fonda for. Let's go back to the Vietnam War.
Let's go way back to that. Well, I think she took offense to it. My understanding is she said that because Jane Fonda seemed to be on this Bash Megan tour where she gave an interview to a magazine and then another, and then she went on the Today Show in front of Hoda and Savannah and kind of brought it up again, the plastic surgery question. I just think, I don't know if that audience at that time of day, this is more like what her Fox show was when she would sort of, you know, really have this prosecutorial style. She's a lawyer and she's very good at breaking things down in this way, pointing out history. I just wonder if it impacts her ability to get great guests in the future.
Maybe a good scandal or a good argument is a good celebrity argument is always a good thing for the ratings and promotion. But the concept that this is really about, why'd you ask me about my plastic surgery? Jane Fonda hates America. I mean, it's like right out of a sketch. Like,
that's been sort of hashed and
rehashed, ridiculous,
right?
Yeah. Isn't it? Well, look what her. She's outraged. Remember Vietnam? Everybody stand up.
Yeah, sitting on the gunner.
I find that to be disingenuous.
Well, disingenuous, and actually even worse than that, if you listen to the ladies of The View, the entire panel had real problems with the inclusion of the Vietnam War. The Wayback File kind of information she brought out in her comments, including Meghan McCain and, oh boy, Joy Behar. Watch out.
We're supposed to be humble. We're supposed to use whatever time we're given to shine a light on other stories. I mean, there are so many stories that we're not covering.
Mm-hmm.
And to take time with this feels exactly
she not just said, Jane should have just said to her, and how much work have you had, bitch?
Well, oh, Joy.
Behar.
Oh, Joy.
Throwing the B word around. Behar.
Oh, boy.
Love it.
We'll let that sit there.
Although that was ridiculous. You can't say that.
You can't ask people about their plastic surgery.
No, you can't throw the B word out on TV just from woman to woman. You can't do that.
There's a lot of... this needs to settle down, that's for sure.
I guess
don't you think?
Yeah,
it's like, wow, people are whipped up into a frenzy about this. Checking in at...
Number two.
32 more women testified during the sixth day of former U.S. gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar's sentencing hearing, each one more emotional than the next. The total number of victim impact statements now, 155. 155.
People should be
women.
Worked up about this.
That alone.
Forget about Jane Fonda's plastic surgery.
Good point. This,
this is the
horrific.
Workup story of 2018.
They were girls at the time. And some of them still are. Maddie Larson, who won three medals at the 2010 U.S. Gymnastics National Championships, gave one of the most harrowing and truly emotional statements so far.
Around the age of 15 or 16, I would start getting panic attacks before leaving to go to the ranch. One time, I was so desperate not to go, I thought faking an injury bad enough was the only way out. I was taking a bath when I decided to push the bath mat aside, splash water on the tiles, get on the floor, and bang the back of my head against the tub hard enough to get a bump, so it seemed like I slipped. My parents immediately took me to the hospital because they thought I had a concussion. I was willing to physically hurt myself to get out of the abuse that I received at the ranch.
That is so hard to hear, isn't it? And you think about the how these girls didn't feel protected, and the ones that did come forward certainly didn't have the venue to find any kind of legitimate sort of reaction.
At some point or another, you just have to ask the question, as an American, and I, you know, support the Olympics, and I watch the Olympics, and all the cheering, everything we do, you just, I feel anger and resentment and shame in the way that that somehow my enjoyment of that sport behind the scenes, they did everything at all costs to make sure that there was no stain on this on U.S. gymnastics, so they covered all this up.
They're America's sweethearts in a lot of ways. And I mean, think it about was just the fact that this horrifying thing was going on behind the scenes. These were mandatory appointments they had to have with him, and then Kayla Maroney's story, I think, is
155.
Horrifying. Yeah,
this is the tip of the iceberg, by the way, too.
What do you mean by that?
A lot of people are going to come down for this. And not one man can do this to 150-plus women.
Absolutely, that's my point. Yeah,
there are plenty of people that you can point the finger at, no question. And you're going to see a whole bunch of people come down from this.
Well, you've already seen a few members of the USA Gymnastics Board or Committee have resigned, and you're probably right. That's just the beginning. We'll continue to follow that story. Checking in at
number one.
Jimmy Kimmel took to his late night show last night to criticize the White House's childish outgoing voicemail message that took a jab at Senate Democrats.
This is what you would hear if you'd called the White House comment line this weekend.
Thank you for calling the White House. Unfortunately, we cannot answer your call today because congressional Democrats are holding government funding, including funding for our troops and other national security priorities, hostage to an unrelated immigration debate. Due to this obstruction, the government is shut down.
So if you're looking for proof that this administration has its eye on the future, they're attacking Democrats by changing the outgoing voicemail on their landline. And a quick tip, if you are calling the White House, don't press 2 for Spanish. You're asking for trouble.
Oh, gee. Things are getting ugly in Washington. Look at that. Coming up after the break here, after we check Judy's news, in 2 minutes, we're going to talk to A.B. Stoddard, get the very latest on the Mueller investigation, some new details there, much more coming up here on WGN. The Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Justin Kaufman sitting in for a row today as he's off for a couple of days.
Yes, I'm excited to be here.
Yay.
5 o'clock hour in this beautiful. Is it beautiful?
I mean, I don't know. Skilling says the temperatures dropped for us.
Well,
and we had hail last night.
It's a beautiful. No, but I would say it's a beautiful Tuesday.
Okay.
Even though it's chilly out, to look outside on Michigan Avenue, it is beautiful. You don't have bad precipitation. There's not a lot
extreme
of
cold is
mush.
What I worry about. I mean, that's coming at some point. And the next
this
week,
this is what you expect from January. It's a beautiful January.
You know, it's interesting. Later, we've got Richard Roper coming up to review the Oscar nominations. One of the things I want to ask him about is how much he thinks the current the social talk of our times right now influences the Oscar voters. You know, you have the sex harassment and that very much alive in Hollywood, those discussions. And then you have the diversity criticism in Hollywood. And if you look at this year's nominees, you really see that reflected. And you see they're obviously the best of the best. It's interesting to see how that those types of social issues
see how that
weigh into someone who's voting
absolutely.
In those very, very important things. But we want to talk Washington right now. A lot going on there. We heard the news in New York Times broke this morning about Attorney General Jeff Sessions being called before Bob Mueller, the special counsel, and that happened last week. They broke it today. Also, Comey has already appeared before him quite some time ago, and we've learned of that today. Then, now the news is, when will the president appear before the special counsel? Let's check in with A.B. Stoddard from Real Clear Politics. Hey, A.B., what do you know? It's an interesting day.
Not obviously. Yeah, of course. When it rains, it pours. I think that these developments are really obviously no surprise because he'd have to talk to Comey and he'd have to talk to Sessions no matter what. Yeah. I don't know how these things get leaked just because I know people who know Bob Mueller well and are working and have worked for him, and he does not allow leaks, and he works very hard to make sure that nothing is leaking. I do know that people that have come before him and they are their attorneys have leaked a few times, but this is an interesting development that we would know about it. Mm-hmm. And it does possibly indicate that maybe he's getting closer to the end, because you start with a low-hanging fruit and you finish with the principles, obviously. Mm-hmm. So we could say that, but at the same time, we really don't truly know.
No, you don't know.
There's, we don't know if he's going to interview President Trump.
Uh-oh.
We lose it. Lose AB there?
There.
We'll wait to get her there. There's another interesting.
That will be.
Oh, there you are.
There he is.
Sorry, AB, we lost you there for just a minute. May want to backtrack just a little bit.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you.
I think that we're not certain that that President Trump will be interviewed in person, or if he'll be asked for written answers to questions, or when. But it seemed, obviously, when you get to the cabinet and you get to the person who was fired while investigating the president's campaign, that you're getting close to the end.
It's interesting, too, because we know there are some negotiations that have been reported by multiple news organizations. The president's attorneys have been trying to negotiate with the special counsel. Well, it makes sense that he'd want to talk to him. But let's talk about the deal of how this goes down. And we know that lying to the FBI is a crime. Perjury before a grand jury is a crime. But an interview with a special counsel, maybe there's some more leeway there. What it seems has been tossed out into the picture is that his attorneys would be more comfortable with this question and answer thing that would be written and presumably given to him in advance. That seems like there's very low risk for the president if that's how this is carried out. Can you imagine that being the case?
Yeah, it seems a little bit strange, but if that's what's being proffered, then that's obviously a legitimate response, written answers to questions. But, there's still there's probably some legal jeopardy for making any false statements or denials that turn out, to be untrue. So I don't know. I think it's still a serious process in which he's going to have to answer questions about stuff that Mueller has learned through other sources. Mm-hmm. And so I have no idea how, we don't know how much the president is legally exposed. We don't know, what Mueller knows. Mm-hmm. And what happens in these investigations is that people are interviewed and the number of sources, the depth of information that is uncovered by the investigators is not known to the people, the witnesses who are testifying along the way. And so that's how you go through the process of starting at the bottom and then ending at the top.
Right.
And I don't know. I guess the written procedure is fine, but it doesn't mean that it's any less serious or consequential for the president.
AB, I'm interested because the president has continued to push bias, political bias in the FBI and special prosecutor's office, especially when it comes to Russia collusion. Of course, the two investigators and the texts going back and forth and the missing texts over months' time. How much does that play into fueling the fact that this might be politically motivated or a witch hunt, as the president says, about finding collusion with Russia?
I think it's clear that the president's allies and supporters have done what they can to really try and attempt to discredit all of the FBI and all of the Department of Justice so that they can question the findings of any report by the special counsel, Robert Mueller. But there are obviously questions that should be answered about what's been revealed in Peter Strzok's text, what an insurance policy was that was discussed, quote, in Andy's office, which was the office of Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe.
Mm-hmm.
What is a secret society?
Yeah,
absolutely. There are real questions to be asked, and we need to determine whether or not there was some kind of intent to destroy the thousands of texts that went missing, or if it was accidental, and some kind of bureaucratic failure. I mean, these really are questions that need to be answered. But it's very clear in their alarming language that they started using a month ago, talking about a coup in the deep state and purges required and people needing to be that they are making, you know, undertaking an effort so that they could question no matter what comes out of our report.
Can we ask you about the ongoing negotiations in Washington with in Congress? We've got a situation now. There's several. It seems like a lot of the reports coming out right now show that both sides seem to be digging in, and maybe at least to me, I want to get your take. Seem farther apart than they were on issues like immigration. You saw the stories today about how conservatives are feeling emboldened. You know, about what happened in round one with the Democrats, and that after this first round, they feel emboldened enough to even go harder with their immigration stance and the bill that they'd like to see. And then you saw Senator Schumer as well say, hey, look, wall spending off the table now. I know I talked about it before. It's not going to talk about it now. It just appears that they're again, digging in and making a hard line in the sand.
Yeah, well, I think if you actually look at the concessions that the Democratic side made on this issue, I think it's pretty impressive how far the immigration hawks have gotten. They literally have gotten changes to the visa lottery system to chain migration, or what's known as family reunification policy, that's been in place for more than 50 years. They have gotten originally they got funding for a wall that would be called fencing and electronics and et cetera.
We lost her.
Oh.
I'll finish
that wasn't
what
she the was right place. That wasn't the right place to lose her.
I know, but it's a good point.
They have 16 days to iron some things out here. And the spending bills on the table, immigration, DACA,
and the question that still needs to be answered is how much does circus barking and politics and everything else that is happening through social media and Twitter and all that kind of stuff, how does that play into making sure that these two sides come together in a bipartisan way?
I think that's what everyone wants. You're
because right now it doesn't seem that way, whether it's White House voicemails or otherwise. You're getting to a certain point where it just feels like, you know,
people want things to get done. They want government
to get in the way. Right.
AB, we'll let you finish up here. I know we had a bad lot.
No, I actually just wanted to jump in with some good news here, which is that we saw 20. Not like big alerting headline news, but we did see 23 senators working across the aisle all weekend long through the office of Susan Collins of Maine, trying to get to a consensus there. The Republicans and the Democrats and President Trump have all said that they want to find something to resolve the situation with the Dreamers. So what people have to remember is this was not a perfect budget deal, and then the Democrats were trying to blow it up on DACA. There is no budget deal. So while we all sort of are attracted to the hot potato of the immigration fight, there is a tremendous challenge ahead trying to get to what they call top line spending numbers. How much will they increase military spending at the request of President Trump? Will Democrats then also get an increase in discretionary domestic spending to go along with that? This will require lifting the caps that were put in place in 2011 in the Budget Control Act that voters will remember was the sequester. And so that is a huge lift that might not even happen in 3 weeks anyway. For Democrats to separate this out from government shutdowns is actually the smart move. You can continue to fight on this issue. It's not a good issue for Republicans to have Dreamers deported starting in March. No. But you really can't attach it to a government funding bill and shut the government down. They were right to pack this in on Monday and not to be held captive by their left.
Makes sense. A.B. Stoddard, thank you so much. Real Clear Politics.
Thank you.
It's the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Rose off for a couple days. Justin Kaufman of The Download is here. This is interesting. Tammy Duckworth tweeted the news that we shared earlier here on WGN, and Judy had in her news earlier. Wanted to share some exciting personal news, and she's got this adorable little picture of a big duck and another big duck and then a little duck and then a little mini duck.
Mm-hmm.
And the line is duck, 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 duckling. She's the first sitting U.S. Senator, if I get this right, Judy, who is pregnant. And so, you know, she is having another little girl.
First in
to give
history.
Birth.
Yeah.
To give birth.
Yes.
Okay.
By the way, we are in the year 2018.
I know. Well, hey, great point. I mean, great point, right? We all had to sit back and say, could that be true? Is that possible? You can be a senator at age 30, and you got a lot of childbearing years ahead of you. And I understand a lot of people move up the political food chain, and it's a slower process. A senator is sometimes you've had a lot of experience under you before you get there, and so you're a little bit older.
Right.
But still.
Yeah, it's an impressive number. Impressive to say that there has not yet to be a sitting senator that was pregnant.
Yeah.
That's absolutely stunning to me.
So that's...
But, and not only that, but a combat veteran.
Yeah.
Which is kind of unusual to be a woman combat veteran.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. So that's fascinating.
Congratulations to Senator Duckworth.
Yeah. So, and you pointed out something earlier, Justin, which I think was when we were talking to A.B. Stoddard of Real Clear Politics about the FBI text messages that are missing.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting because it speaks to this. And some, we had some texters who said, oh, good, you're finally talking about that or whatever. And it speaks to this tribalized world we're living in, that if you watched the Fox News, you'd hear a lot about the FBI text messages. And if you watched mostly CNN today, you would have heard a lot about the porn star payoff that the president made. And
illegal.
Was it illegal or not because of election laws? And
I have to say, in this day and age, it blows my mind that everything that we've gone through, whether it be Hillary's emails or any of the collusion investigation, or even before that, the investigations of the last 10, 15 years, that you would be in any situation where someone who works for the federal government would be like, yeah, we just can't find 6 months of those records. I just can't even believe that. And that's, I can understand why people would be incensed or irate about that, because it's at a certain point, you're like, come on, man, you can't just not have those records.
In interest of transparency of government, it does seem strange now.
It was on their personal phones, and they're going to have to, go through. I get that. But it just drives me crazy because, you can make any political argument you want off the fact that there's missing, it's just missing missing text messages in an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do that.
Yeah. I think the fact that they're exchanged between two people who are already being questioned in terms of their allegiances.
That's the problem.
Their political views might have influenced their work in the FBI. That's the question.
Yeah.
We've got a lot more coming up. We've got Richard Roper coming here to talk about the Oscars.
Looking forward to it.
Oh, I know. I am too. And then a very special guest about doing the God's work here in Chicago. That's coming up. We're going to break, though, here in 2 minutes, Judy's News. It's the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Justin Kaufman of The Download is here. Richard Roper is here, and we are happy about that. Boy, are we happy, because we're talking Oscar nominations. And I remember, Richard, you, when you were here reviewing The Shape of Water, which has like 13, it's got the most, right?
Yes.
Nominations. And it was interesting because you're like, there's this amphibious creature, and there's this woman who can't speak. And we're like, what? What? You're like, it's a great movie. And I remember Ro and I were sitting here like, how can that be? You're like, you get past it, you get into this movie, it's incredible.
I think 13 is about as many nominations as you can get, right, Justin?
I mean, it's amazing.
Because you can't get nominated for like best animated short and certain categories. So I think for a fictional movie, maybe 14, 13 might be the most you can win.
Because
it's every category. Yeah,
it's tying the record of Titanic.
And, I admired the film more than I loved it, because it's really well done. And it's beautifully done. And Del Toro's a great director who I think, is a favorite of critics and people in Hollywood. So
you're surprised by this?
No, but I do think it could be one of those things, one of those films that has a ton of nominations and not a lot of victories.
And it might win in some of the secondary categories, like costumes or makeup and things like that, but maybe director, or maybe not this movie.
I think this is going to be one of those years where director and picture are separate, because it's interesting. Three Billboards, I don't think he got the writer director. Martin McDonagh, I know he got a screenplay nomination in the Best Picture, but I don't think he got a nomination for Best Director, which is the movie directed itself to all those nominations. and Guillermo del Toro. Now I sound like Tiffany Haddish. She couldn't get anybody's names right
there
in the nomination. Felt so bad for her, because Andy Serkis, who of course is, the king of motion picture acting, and he's British, he'd like, and the nominees are Sally Hawkins, Shape of Water. And then she'd be like, and Gruzgata, Brzgatitko, she got all the hard names.
She's
and
like,
he got
oh.
like, you know,
How do you say the Ronin one? The 23-year-old has been nominated
Sheer
three times.
Sheer Shuck. Yeah. And right. She was like, you know, Soiree's Ronan for, you know, I felt bad for
her. They don't have like a little earpiece to put in for
they could have, yeah. I thought that, you know, I think you got to sit down with the presenters beforehand. Yeah. You guys know what it's like. Yeah. You go over the pronunciations in advance.
Yeah, it's cold.
The big
easy.
Story locally, Lori Metcalf in Chicago. Yeah. So that's good for Chicago, I guess.
Absolutely. And, you know, she's so good. And I know she's won multiple Emmys for the original Roseanne, right? And various stage awards. She's great. You know, guys, you guys know Lori Metcalf. Uh-huh. She's so great as the mom in Lady Bird. The classic mother-daughter relationship where they love each other and they hate each other, sometimes in the same sentence, you know? and especially that dynamic, you know? And you know... You know, for people who haven't seen it, Lady Bird, you know, it's basically set in, the early 2000s, and Saoirse Ronan plays a high school senior. But you know that mother-daughter relationship is going to be, they're going to be best friends when she's 40 and her mom's 65. Yeah. But right now, she wants to literally jump out of the car when her mother is driving her nuts. But and I think Laurie has a chance, because as you know, supporting actress is the one category where you get the odd upset from time to time.
Well, I was going
to
ask just about how nostalgic or how romanticized the Academy is when it comes to people like Lori Metcalf or Gary Oldman for Darkest Hour.
Sure.
People who haven't won before but are in that category where they know they're great actors.
Sure.
Does that help in a situation like this?
You know, it's interesting because just when you think they are, you know, super sentimental, you know, Lauren Bacall, you know, is ready for her crowning moment to get an Oscar and she doesn't win. And Stallone, everybody thought Sly was going to get that Oscar because
yes.
It's first, like, you know, and he's become such a popular figure as well as obviously a beloved figure, and he played the circuit, he was everywhere,
right.
and I think, you know, he just absolutely thought he was going to win Best Supporting Actor, and then Mark Rylance, who's probably going to win four more anyway, steals it from him. So I don't know, don't know this year because you look at, let's talk about Supporting Actor, Christopher Plummer, 88
yes.
years old,
88,
right,
the oldest,
you know, did the amazing job of filling in for Kevin Spacey. Mm-hmm. So, you know, obviously he didn't have a lot of time to prep and was great. And I saw some of the Spacey performance, and honestly, he looked like Kevin Spacey in old man makeup. And Christopher Plummer looked like J.P. Getty, you know, because he's close to the age. He's actually older than Getty was at the time, and he was great. But I don't know, man. I think Sam Rockwell's going to win. You know, those are the categories, the supporting categories when you're filling out your pools, you can take a chance on somebody.
There was some great news in terms of, you know, there's been a lot of diversity criticism in Hollywood and a lot of firsts. Mary J. Blige, Octavia Spencer. Mary J. Blige, first to be nominated to perform as a performer and an original song.
That's pretty cool.
Octavia Spencer, first black actress to get multiple Oscar nominations in the 90s.
For playing a maid, also.
I know.
God love her.
Dear.
Best performance playing a maid in the early 1960s, Octavia Spencer and Octavia Spencer.
And then Jordan Peele, first African-American to earn Oscar noms.
How about Jordan Peele?
Three categories. Picture, director, screenplay.
I mean, and here's a guy who, I mean, if I told you 2 years ago, the guy from that really funny, you know, show with all the skits that go on, you know, the viral videos is going to get a nomination. Three nominations.
Or the guy from Pitch Perfect,
debut.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty amazing for
him. It's pretty cool. And, you know, and he deserves it because it's such an original piece of work. And then same thing for Kumail Nanjiani, right? Who, of course, you know, talk about Chicago connections, who met Emily Gordon here in Chicago, who's now his wife. And, you know, they based that story on their real relationship. And can you imagine, like, even he was saying, can you imagine if, when I met her 12 years ago, I said, you know what? We're going to write a screenplay about this one day and get nominated. That would have been the corniest scene in the movie.
Yeah, it would have been.
And it is true. good for them
it
as well.
Good.
Big
I mean,
sick, yeah.
We were talking about this earlier. Maybe, Richard, you can explain this too, because you understand a little more about this nominating process. And how much does, okay, we know there's a little bit of a game you have to play as somebody who's trying to get one of these awards, you know, some whatever that is. But then there's also this time we're living in where sex harassment is very much big deal. And James Franco didn't get it. Okay. You saw the Christopher Plummer thing.
Right.
I'm sure they're all very worthy in their categories to even come close.
Sure.
And then the diversity criticism, as I mentioned, too. I mean, how much do all these sort of social issues affect people who are voting?
Yeah,
are they
able
to put it all aside and say, I'm going to judge this purely on the performance or purely on
the past, they certainly have, because they've honored the likes of Woody Allen, and even Roman Polanski long after even Roman Polanski, you know, has pretty much acknowledged, you know, heinous wrongdoing. You know, in the James Franco case, he won the Golden Globe, you know, for Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy. And that was really the night where things sort of, you know, Ali Sheedy and others were tweeting. Although a lot of that was known beforehand. And I believe the Academy voting closed about 2 days after the Globes. Oh, wow. Still enough time, though, because a lot of the Academy members wait until the last minute to cast their votes. And I think for sure that's why James Franco didn't get the nomination. You know, Denzel Washington is one of our greatest actors of all time. I think that's his eighth nomination. Yeah. But I don't even know if he saw Roman J. Israel Esquire. You know, and I did. I don't know. And I mean, he was terrific in it, but nobody saw that coming. You know, and I do believe that the Denzel nomination is where Franco would have been nominated. And I think a lot of Academy members, you know, you can't peer into their hearts and souls, my feeling is that at least some of them, you know, they thought about this and said, well, now you're going to have James Franco on the red carpet if he shows up and he's nominated. And now who's going to start asking him questions about the allegations? And what if he steps onto the stage or enters the theater and is booed? Or a number of women stand up and face the other way? Or what if more allegations come out? I knew he wasn't going to get a nomination at 7:30 this morning because ABC, which is carrying the Oscars, at 7:30 this morning, they had already started reading the announcements of the nominations. They were airing an interview with two of his accusers on Good Morning America. I mean, the timing of that. Now, obviously, they didn't affect it. The votes were already in.
No, no.
But it just showed you how much at the forefront it was, right?
What were the other big snubs? I mean, everybody talks about Franco, but what were the other snubs that you thought people were deserving?
Well, you know, I think sometimes people, you know, Meryl Streep got her 21st nomination, but Tom Hanks not getting a nomination and Spielberg not getting a nomination, I feel
seems
is
weird.
If somebody else, if you didn't know, if it wasn't Tom Hanks, it was another actor in that role, he would have been nominated. And if it wasn't Steven Spielberg, if it was just some, you know, director, the film itself. So I do feel with the Academy, too, they go, geez, those guys, you know, have special rooms built for all their trophies. They don't need to get nominated. And I know, too, that, you know, that there's about 6,000 plus members of the Academy. And for the nominations, you vote in your own branch. So directors vote for directors, actors. Now, and then for the Oscars, now everybody votes. So I feel like sometimes maybe a director or, you know, will say, gosh, you know, I love Stevie, but I'm going to vote for my friend, blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
Who's never, you know, Christopher Nolan never nominated before, which is incredible. When you look at Memento and you look at the Dark Knight films.
Ridley Scott also snubbed this year for All the Money in the World. Does that bother you?
You know, I like the film. I didn't think it was Oscar level. He's certainly one of the all time greats. But you know, other than that, you know, the acting nominees were pretty much who we thought they were going to be. A lot of the same people we've seen mentioned, you know, elsewhere. Gary Oldman's a lock to win for Best Actor as Churchill. I mean,
he's amazing in that.
Yeah, and he should win. But it's also one of those things. If you're a British actor playing a famous historical figure in a biopic, you're in, baby.
Yeah, speaking of Oscar worthy, Boss Baby. Boss Baby.
Yeah.
How does that work? Well, how do you say Academy Award nominated Boss Baby?
I feel, and they can do this, and they have in the past, if there's only three nomination worthy movies, only have three. And you know Trump is going to be campaigning for Boss Baby over that Coco with the Mexicans, and they're going across the border. So, you know,
he kind of is a Boss Baby.
He's the Boss Baby.
I think the Boss Baby is played by Alec Baldwin, though, so maybe that won't work out for Trump.
I also feel the Minions will be marching. No accolades for Despicable Me. What was it, three? Come on!
I was happy to see Dunkirk. I love that movie. You recommended that movie to me. I went to see it with my mom, who lost a relative on the beaches, Dunkirk.
Wow.
And it was such a powerful movie.
Definitely, wow.
So and that one had 8 Oscar nominations. Like, no surprise there.
Pretty strong. You know, and I think that's another one that might get a lot of nods and then maybe not a lot of wins. I think it's going to be spread out this year. I don't see any film. I mean, Three Billboards, you know, if it has a chance in almost every category it's nominated in. So I think it had 7, so it didn't have nearly as many nominations as some of the other films. But it could take home 4 or even 5 big ones, which would obviously be a huge night for a film that deserves more exposure, I think.
Yeah. I do too. I don't know everyone who went out to see that, but you're like, you got to see it. I thought, didn't you strongly recommend that?
Absolutely. It was my pick as the best movie of the year.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in the supporting actor category, you know, talking about, you know, Christopher Plummer does have a good shot to win. You may see a split because Sam Rockwell and Woody Harrelson are both nominated for their, and deservedly so, but they're both, so they might split the Ebbing vote.
And I was going to say, he probably doesn't have a chance to win, but Willem Dafoe in Florida Project is pretty special.
He was. And you know, he might, just because, again, going back to nominated a few times, but never won. And he's, you know, I've been lucky enough to meet him a few times at dinner with him at Sundance, and you know, he's so scary looking. I mean, he was the Green Goblin before he put the mask on, right? But he is so sweet and such a lovely gentleman. You know, it's just a testament to what a great actor he is, because so often he plays creepy guys. Now, in the Florida Project, he's the closest thing to a hero. Yeah. I mean, he's the only the adult in that movie. Yeah. I didn't want to call child services on, basically, right? I mean, totally. And what a wonderful performance in that film.
This is The Real Concha with me, Anna DeVlantis. We're talking Oscars with none other than Richard Roper. Richard, we also we have a first in the cinematography, first woman in the history of the Oscars, 90-year mm-hmm. history, to become nominated in that category. A lot of firsts this year, actually.
Yeah, yeah, pretty impressive. Well, in the last, remember since the Oscars So White campaign of, what, 2-3 years ago, mm-hmm. The Academy has added 700 new members, and many, many of them younger and quite a diverse group. And I think you're starting to see that. I mean, that's like 10% of the membership, maybe a little bit more than that at this point. I think you're starting to see that reflected in the nominations. It, you know, the people who are nominated deserve to get nominated, but it's nice to also see it reflecting a little bit more what the movies look like.
Yeah. All right. Let me ask an ignorant question. What happens now? I mean, are they already picked who the winner is and all that is already done? Or is there actual campaign where all these people...
No, there's... the voting, there is a campaign, and you will see it. And you'll see, you know, I know, I'm with you. And this year, they moved it all the way back to the first weekend in March. So March Madness,
yeah,
you know?
So they're going to be... They're just going to be a ton of just publicity for all of these
actors.
And
you will see, as we talked about, some of these actors will be making the rounds, and they have luncheons, and they have lots of screenings, especially in Hollywood. And other actors will be out, you know, working on projects or kind of letting it go. You know, Gary Oldman's a great guy, but he's not going to... I don't see him doing a ton of mean tweets and stuff on the late night circuit. Although he'd be great at it, you know. But I think you will see. But yeah, and especially, you know, like some of the actors we're talking about. You know, Woody Harrelson is a great actor, but, you know, he'd rather get high with Willie Nelson in Maui than worry about this. You know, that's his life, man. You know, if he wins, yeah, exactly. And it shouldn't matter, but it does. It's like any other campaign. I bet Hillary wishes she had set foot in Wisconsin. Yeah.
Right.
Too soon, too late. No. Too late. Hashtag too late.
Well, very relevant for sure.
I think I'll be on a stage with LeBron James and Hollywood celebrities because I've already won the election. Wrong.
When's the deadline for the vote?
I'm not sure the exact deadline, but yeah, it's maybe I want to say a week beforehand. Okay. And man, if they change the rules for that, by the way, they're going to have 17 people who know the winners. They're going to have it rehearsed. They have to know all the names. No tweeting. 2 envelopes on top of 4 envelopes. I mean, they ain't going to mess it up this time.
That's right. It was just last year, wasn't it?
Although, you know, at some point, you know, Kimmel's been doing some pretty funny bits already, but I think at some point he's going to open and something say like, Moonlight, you guys won again.
Yeah, right.
So overall, you were...
People always say bad year, good year for films. There's so many films. You can always find a lot of great films. But you look at the roster of nominated movies and the performances, boy, there's not a clunker in the bunch. I mean, just really, really good work out there. And I hope people see some of the films, because a lot of people say, well, I've only seen 2 of the nominated pictures. Well, you got plenty of time to go out and see them now.
What would you recommend if you haven't already seen? Gotta see
3 Billboards. 3 Billboards. For sure.
I want to see that so badly.
You know, Dunkirk, I think. And I think... Just if you're a fan, you want to watch, you got to see The Shape of Water just because it has so many nominations. And then make up your own mind. You'll either be rooting for it or you'll hope it goes 0-13 and pulls a color purple.
I totally put that in.
Remember that? Oprah was like, I'm glad we lost in all the categories. It makes us more famous.
And everyone gets a free car. Thanks, Richard. It is The Real Concha Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Justin Kaufman of The Download is here with us this afternoon. We're wrapping things up with this incredible project you need to know about. It is called Project Onward, and we have with us the executive director for Project Onward, also one of the artists there. So, Nancy Gomez, why don't you lead us off? You're the executive director. Tell us about this special place. You're located in Bridgeport, and you have these wonderfully exceptional artists who display their works there.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Thanks for being here.
Project Onward is a studio and gallery for adult visual artists with mental disabilities and disorders, and we provide the studio space as well as all the materials for our artists to create art. And what makes us different from any other studio or gallery is that we pay our artists when we sell the art. They get 50%.
Wonderful. How did this all materialize? How'd you come up with the idea to do this?
Back in 2004, after Gallery 37, some of the artists that were there aged out of the Gallery 37 program. They graduated high school, one of them being my nephew.
Oh.
And a couple of the teachers there decided that they needed some place to go after high school. And so Project Onward was created.
A natural graduation for that whole thing. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful.
Well, let's bring the artist in. Let's bring in Andrew. Andrew Hall is an artist with Project Onward. Andrew, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Talk about your art. I mean, obviously, we're going to get into what you guys got coming up next month, but talk about, I mean, get an opportunity to give us the elevator pitch on what you produce as an artist. What can we expect to see from you at Project Onward at the Bridgeport Art Center?
Well, you can expect a whole bunch of realistic work with a whole bunch of color work and everything, like a lot of graphite, a lot of pen work.
Okay.
There's a lot of painting techniques and everything that I do. I do portraits, I do buildings, I do trains, I do landscapes, seascapes, you name it, I name it, I do it all.
Do you do, when you say landscapes and things like that, is some of, I know you're from Chicago, is this inspired by Chicago, or is this inspired
everything.
From everywhere?
I actually went to Germany about 4 years ago for a project I did for CTA.
Yeah.
And I was commissioned by them. And they sent me to Germany but I had to complete the project. And then they sent me out there for a glass project. And I was there for like 10 days. I was able to, you know, look at the color features and everything. And then we went to this place called the Nordschweinzern Castle. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the pieces that I actually done so far, as far as like, you know, going outside the country and looking at the landscapes. And so the castle was, it was about 11 by 14. It was pen and ink and watercolor.
And the castle.
Yes.
What inspired that?
Just by going there and then looking at the whole like architectural, inspired by the King Ludwig. And there was something that I wanted to, you know, bring back to Chicago. And so when I got the picture and I just like, you know what, let me just make this look great. And so like I remember like doing like Thanksgiving break, I had about like 2 weeks left to complete like this project that I was doing, because I was working on like several other projects. And so I stayed up to like, I did like 16 hours a day just working really hard on it. And then when it got to like the last day, I was like I was up to like 10 o'clock in the morning.
Oh man.
And it came out great. It was so realistic. Like you could see like the details in the castle, you could see like the people, the trees, like the whole landscape, the water and everything.
Nancy, when we listen to Andrew's story, how do you select the artists for Project Onward? Talk about how you get involved with the project.
Artists find their way to us one way or the other. Sometimes they come through high school counselors, or they come through social workers, or they just hear about us. And what they would do then is contact us and bring in their portfolio. And through a series of interviews, we decide, and they decide, whether we're a good fit for each other, because we have about 50 artists ranging from the age of 22 through 65, and we're like a family.
Mm.
So they don't necessarily have to have a professional artistic background or schooling. They just have to be good artists, and That's basically it.
I'm intrigued because I've seen the work. I've been at the Bridgeport Arts Center. Love it. Mm-hmm. And I've
Thank
seen
you.
The Project Onward stuff. It's a great, especially you go on the Fridays when the whatever the month is that you
Our third
you
know, Friday.
Third, day, fri- mm-hmm. third Fridays. It's interesting because it's not art therapy. There's a distinction here. This is not art therapy for people who have disabilities, mental or physical. This is honoring the artists that have those ailments and their art, not necessarily doing it to be some sort of therapy.
You're absolutely right. We don't teach art. What we do is inspire art. And we do that by telling our artists that we're having an event, such as the one we're going to have now with the honoring legendary African-American artists.
Mm-hmm.
And the artists get inspired by something like that, and then they just run with it. And we're always so surprised to see the outcome of it.
You mentioned it's like a family. Is it also a place where artists inspire each other? I mean, you're talking about people who are naturally creative and already so accomplished, but then they come together, I would imagine, that creates great energy.
Absolutely. Especially when a new artist comes in and brings a new type of art that they may be doing, other artists will look at it and say, wow, maybe I could try that. Mm-hmm. But also, we also try to push the boundaries of our artists, too, because after all, they're artists, and they're always thinking about something that means something really special to them. So in the case of the African-American artist event that we're having, we've asked some artists to do something they haven't done either in a long time or something they've never done at all. So one artist may be doing artwork in foil. He creates sculptures in foil. We asked him to do it in clay, and it's unbelievable what he did. Another artist we asked to actually paint in paint, and because he usually draws with colored pencils. Mm. And he said, wow, I haven't done that in 8 years. Mm. But he took to it like a duck to water, and we just can't, you know, we're just astounded by the artwork that comes out of it.
I want to bring Andrew back in. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm intrigued because, you know, you might think automatically when you're talking about art that's being done, and we said it's not therapy, but a collective of artists that are coming in who both have mental and physical disabilities, that would somehow hinder the art. Talk about, and I know this is, talk about how your disability helps your art. How does it make you stand out in terms of the art that you produce and the artist that you are?
Well, it basically helped me to get stronger, like, every day. Like, if I'm having a bad day or something, or if I'm feeling down or depressed about something, or something could be going on, like, I always try to find ways how to come back, like, a lot stronger. It's almost like lifting weights, basically. It's like a lot of times, like, you're going to have people that's going to, like, doubt you a lot. So what I try to do is I try to come up with ways, like, you know, be stronger. Like, every day, like, I would find, like, new methods. Like, I was listening to music. Like, I have my headphones on. I listen to, like, my favorite music every day. Like, keep inspired. Mm-hmm. Or I might look at something that might inspire me one day, and next, you know, come back with something, like, totally different. Like, they'd be like, how do you do that? Like, my music.
The music, yeah.
You know, it's interesting because someone with such talent like yours, artistic mm-hmm. talent, and you meet people that are special like you who have that. And you just, there aren't enough venues, there aren't enough avenues for people like you to thrive because being an artist is tough, let's face it. But you've created something here that really can make it a career for you.
Actually, I have. I've been doing art since I was about 2 years old.
Wow.
And I remember a story that I haven't really told anybody, but I told some people about it when I was about 6 years old. There was a pair of Jordans I used to want when I was about six. And so my cousin had them. And so I was over his house one time. And so I used to tell my dad, I was like, dad, I want these gym shoes, like, real, real bad. And he was like, well, I'm going to see what I could get you. So he bought me, like, some patching you in gym shoes. So you know what I did? I thought, you know, went on my cousin's house. And then when I went home, this is back in, like, 92. Mm-hmm. So what I did was I drew the shoe out with a blue Pilot pen on a notebook paper on each side, and I took some scissors, and I took some scotch tape, and I taped it on both sides of my shoes. Ah. And I wrapped around my house God. Like, it's my new Jordans. And it looked exactly like the shoe, too.
And they did. Mm-hmm. So you knew then.
And I drew that all in from my head, too, actually.
Oh, my gosh. Some people just have these gifts.
Some of the artists that that are inspiring the work, the influential African-American painters and sculptors, Kerry James Marshall comes to mind here in Chicago. How important is it for the artists that work at Project Onward to be inspired by not just great African-American artists, but Chicago artists? Kerry James Marshall from here. Talk about how important it is to have that local flair to Project Onward.
Well, Project Onward artists struggle with mental illness or disability every day, but they can come here, create art, and become more confident with themselves, especially through the sale of their art. Other artists overcome shyness and depression while creating their art at Project Onward.
So tell us how people can see, can go to see this, and you have an upcoming reception and event. Exactly the details for us.
Sure. The National Endowment for the Arts, as well as the Chicago Community Trust, gave us a grant to exhibit these 15 portraits of legendary African-American artists during Black History Month. And it's a ticketed event, and you can go to projectonward.org to volunteer, to buy tickets, to donate, and we you could also come to the Bridgeport Art Center. We're on the fourth floor, and you could visit us and actually look at all the art and talk to the artist as well. They love to have visitors.
Andrew, to wrap up, I mean, what's it mean to you to be a part of this, to be a part of this that's coming up this next month? I mean, what's, as an artist who's a part of Project Onward, talk about how important it is for you.
It feels great because I finally have a big opportunity to express my creativity, and I think with this project right here, there's a little bit more going on besides like the realistic stuff. So it's like a little bit of like the design part, and it's like a mixture of realist. So it's like two styles put together, and I think it's going to be great.
And this is also a 501c. People can make donations, I assume. Would you just go to your website for that?
Absolutely. Again, projectonward.org. You can go to donate and purchase tickets for the event. And if you want to help us out more, you can volunteer. We're always looking for volunteers.
Wonderful.
That's great.
Hey, you mentioned someone in your family is also still involved, or was...
Yes, my nephew? Lewis, yes, he's still an artist there. He comes in maybe once a week, and he has a project over at the 606, mm-hmm. So he keeps pretty busy with his art. But he has auditory problems, so he comes in and he keeps his earphones on the whole time, but he loves coming in and talking and hanging out with the rest of the crew.
Well, it's wonderful to see so many artists inspired and thriving in this environment that you've created. So thank you for sharing it with us. Nancy Gomez, Executive Director for Project Onward, and Andrew Hall, one of the artists. Head over to projectonward.org if you want
Thanks,
some
guys.
More information.
Thank you.
Thank you.